Welcome everyone to Philosophy as a Way of Life. I am Massimo Pilucci. I'm a professor of philosophy at the City College of New York. And here with me is my co-host, Rob Coulter from the University of Wyoming. Hi, Rob. How are you?
I'm good, Massimo. How are you?
Not bad. It's a beautiful day in New York, 64 degrees and sunny.
Enjoy it.
I heard it's not the same for you, right?
It is not. It's a bit more brisk in Wyoming, up in the mountains.
It happens.
Yep.
All right. Before we get into today's topic, which I'm very much looking forward to, let me announce the next episode of Philosophy as a Way of Life, which will feature authors Megan Sullivan and Paul Blanchko on their book, The Good Life Method, Reasoning Through the Big Questions of Happiness, Faith, and Meaning. If you're interested in that episode, join us live on Thursday, March 3rd at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. If you want to register for that event, which you need to do if you want to join us, go to meetup.com and look for the New York Agora. In the meantime, if you wish to hear past episodes of Philosophy as a Way of Life, as well as the one that we're just about starting, probably available tomorrow, go to anchor.fm/philosophy as a way of life. And now today's topic, we have a guest, Georges Dreyfus, on Buddhism and Stoicism. George spent 15 years in Buddhist monasteries, so he really knows from experience what he's talking about today, before receiving in 1985 the title Geshe, the highest degree conferred by Tibetan monastic universities. He then entered the University of Virginia, where he received his PhD in the History of Religions program, and he's currently professor of religion at the Department of Religion at Williams College, and teaches in the philosophy department as well. He has published 5 books, including Recognizing Reality, Dharmakirti and His Tibetan Interpreters, and The Sound of Two Hands Clapping, The Education of a Tibetan Buddhist Monk. George has also published many articles on various aspects of Buddhist philosophy and Tibetan culture. He is the recipient of an award from the National Endowment for the Humanities. George, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right, Rob, let's get it started.
Great. Well, George, very nice to meet you. And looking forward to this conversation and learning a thing or two. I just wanted to start with kind of a general question, right? Our audience is probably mostly more Stoicism focused, and Stoicism is often compared to Buddhism in a number of ways. But Buddhism seems to have a longer sort of continuous history than does Stoicism. And wouldn't it be better then to think about Buddhisms as opposed to one thing? Maybe you could say a little bit about that developmental picture.
Okay, maybe I should say the perspective I will inhabit here, which is what is called Buddhist modernism. Buddhism has obviously a complicated history, moved to several different cultures, moved to China, Japan, Tibet, Mongolia, Southeast Asia. Those are really different cultures if you know them. And so we could spend, a semester just talking about these differences. I think what's probably more helpful is that I talk about the perspective I will take in this discussion, which is what is called Buddhist modernism, which is a way to understand Buddhism as being, as espousing views that are in harmony or not contradicting or not kind of so different from modern standards of thinking, particularly scientifically informed standards of thinking. And so this movement originated in Southeast Asia and South Asia, Sri Lanka, Thailand, as a way for Buddhists to come to terms with modernity. One of its stellar representative, or two of its stellar representative, are the Dalai Lama on one side, and Buddha Dasa in Thailand on the other side. And they are Buddhist modernists who think about Buddhism, how we can understand Buddhism from a modern perspective, kind of bypassing the metaphysical agendas, sorry about that, the metaphysical agenda that traditions such as Buddhism, but also Stoicism have, right? So it's very much my perspective here, talking not so much about the metaphysics of Buddhist reincarnation, karma, and all these things, but rather more what we can get as modern people who are interested in leading the good life, what we can understand from Buddhist ideas and Buddhist practice. That's a perspective I think that is going to inform me throughout this talk, if that makes sense.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Did you want to follow up on that, Massimo?
Well, I think we can get straight into the first substantive question, which I think it's going to have to do with the Stoics, modern Stoics, because Stoicism also has similar distinction, of course. The difference, the big difference being that Stoicism, in a sense, got interrupted basically after the second or third century. As we know, it influenced Western culture through Christianity and early modern philosophy, but nevertheless, as a freestanding philosophy, got sort of interrupted until the 20th century. Nevertheless, there is a distinction, of course, between modern Stoicism and ancient Stoicism. Now, a lot of modern Stoics talk about the so-called dichotomy of control, which is not a term that you find in ancient Stoicism, but it is a concept that you certainly do find in Epictetus and arguably earlier. And this is the notion that, as Epictetus puts it, some things are up to us and other things are not up to us. And that a good life is one in which you focus on where your agency is in fact effective, the things that are up to us, try to develop an attitude of equanimity toward things that are not up to us, equanimity and acceptance. And of course, Epictetus' own twist on this is that really pretty much the only thing that is up to us is our judgments, our decisions to act or not to act, our endorsed values, but those are all judgments. Everything else, outcomes of our actions are not up to us. Now, however, the same idea is found in different cultures. And I wonder if you think it is also found in Buddhism. I mean, one of my notes mentions an 8th century Buddhist scholar, Shantideva, who wrote, if there is a remedy when trouble strikes, what reason is there for dejection? Mm-hmm. If there is no help for it, what use is there in being glum? So do you think that we're talking about the same thing more or less? And do you think this is a influence of one culture over the other, or is that a general universal idea that people sort of hit on independently?
Okay, so there is the historical aspect to that and the philosophical aspect to that, right? So the historical, obviously, we don't really know. I believe that Stoicism arose mostly after the Alexandrian conquest, right? And so I have always thought that a tradition like Stoicism and Skepticism, another tradition I'm very much interested in for comparative reason, that those arose as a result of a kind of contact with the Indian world. Now, this is obviously a hypothesis, and it doesn't mean that one tradition adopted what the other tradition had. It just means that cultural development are favored by encounter with other cultures, right? And so I often thought for myself that maybe this kind of orientation towards a different kind of practical wisdom, which I think there is in Stoicism, but obviously I know very little about this tradition, but this might have been a result of an encounter with this ideal, which is very prevalent in India at that time, which is this idea of kind of yogic or ascetic or meditative practice as a way to control one's mind and lead, if you want to say, the good life, to put it in Greek terms. So I think for me, I think this Alexandrian moment was a moment of interchange between India and Greece, and maybe that influenced Stoics, that influenced some development in Hellenistic philosophy, in the same way that it may also have influenced Indian philosophy, and particularly Buddhist philosophy, as found in the text like The Question of King Milinda, which seemed to be the first attempt for Buddhists to formulate a kind of systematic view of reality. King Milinda being a Greek king, Menander, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's very much this moment of exchange between the Greek world and the Indian world that happened in what's Western Pakistan, Afghanistan, and this area of the world that occurred, right? Now, as to the philosophical formulation, yeah, I'm glad to learn that this dichotomy of what can be controlled or not controlled is actually a modern formulation, because I don't find it formulated in those terms in Buddhism, but it is very much what the Buddha taught about, which is that Buddhism is about the word control is complicated. You can call discipline, right. You can call develop, cultivate, control, however you want to call, use whatever word you want to use. That's very much what Buddhism is, at least as far as the central doctrine is concerned. That's very much what Buddhism is about. So there may be this historical connection. And certainly there is kind of, in my mind, a kind of meeting between these different traditions that focus on the cultivation of the mind as the central focus of leading the good life, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I mean, I agree with you that the word control is problematic. I don't like it myself, but unfortunately, this is the terminology. Yeah.
We use words and so on.
Right.
It's what is important is that we understand. Obviously, when we say control, we understand that we cannot force the mind, right?
Correct.
What we have to do is cultivate the mind so mm-hmm. as to generate. Right. Wholesome habits and undermine unwholesome habits. That's what we're talking about, right?
Yes. Let me ask you just from my own curiosity, in terms of when is it that the earliest surviving Buddhist texts become available? And the reason I'm asking this is because in Stoicism, there is a similar issue with the early sources. That is, we only have fragments from almost all of the Greek Stoics, you know, Zeno, yeah, Chrysippus, Cleanthes. We only have fragments, and usually those fragments, of course, are reported by much, much later sources. Mm-hmm. I think that the earliest thing that is not a fragment is actually Cicero. And then, of course, we have mm-hmm. Epictetus mm-hmm. And Seneca. Yeah. So we're talking already several centuries after the beginning of Stoicism. What's the situation with Buddhism in terms of early sources?
Well, the earliest sources are fragments, again, that were found mostly in Afghanistan, and that date probably around 1st century, 5th century BC, 1st century AD, because Afghanistan is a very dry climate, so you can keep. But this is where kind of pieces of parchment, which attest to the fact that Buddhist texts were written down from around that time, around the turn of the millennium. But this is, we have only fragments of the text that were written down. The Pali Canon that claims to be the earlier canon is formulated, probably written down around the 4th century AD.
Wow. Yeah.
Slightly before, you have a Chinese translation that are probably about one or two centuries earlier. So it's around this time, between 3-5th century, which obviously is a very long time from the Buddha.
Yeah.
So when I teach my classes on the Buddha, on Buddhism, I never say the Buddha said, I always say the Buddha is depicted as saying,
right?
So on, and because this is all what we know. And then I have pitchwork fight with some of my Buddhist scholar colleagues, whether to which extent we can rely on this canon or that canon to understand what the Buddha is was teaching. I myself have fun fighting with my colleagues, but I don't consider it a very important issue because I think what is important for me is not just what the Buddha said, but what the whole tradition conveys. And that tradition is clearly based on some central message we could talk about the Four Noble Truths. And that's basically what I think I want to focus on in Buddhist terms. And I think probably that's same for you too, right?
It's yes, like the message the tradition. Is more important than
yeah. Than yes. who yeah. said who said the what? Founder yeah. was, right? Yeah.
That's great. I wanted to follow up, well, not really follow up, but I wanted to move to sort of a slightly different, maybe, philosophical idea that a lot of modern Stoics and maybe modern Buddhists like try to connect. And that's the idea that we talk of mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a big thing, obviously, in modern Western Buddhism, as well as something like that in the Greek tradition that's usually associated with the Greek term prosoche, which is sometimes translated as attention. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you had something to say about that connection. Do you find that connection compelling, or are they talking about different things, or...
Well, I don't know about the Greek side. You will tell me.
Okay.
What I think is, I think what is interesting to talk about is basically two strategies to try to cultivate control, whatever term. Let's use the word control, but let's make clear we are not trying to force the mind. We're just trying to cultivate the mind, right? So that to me is quite important. And I think that's why I think modern Stoics should pay attention to Buddhist meditation, particularly mindfulness. And so let me explain what I mean with two strategies. One strategy is what I call a top-down strategy, which is based on changing our judgment, reformulating how we conceptualize a particular situation. And that's what we find in CBT. And to my understanding, that's what I think most of what I hear about Stoic meditations are about, right? And you find a lot of these meditations in Buddhist tradition as well, meditation on death, meditation on the preciousness of human life, meditations on the qualities of the Buddha, meditations on loving kindness, sympathetic joy, and so on. So there are a lot of meditations that use this, what I call top-down strategy. Now, the problem with the top-down strategy is that human beings are the product of a very long evolution. And this here, obviously, I'm stepping out of the traditional way to explain Buddhism, and I'm wearing my Buddhist modernist hat, right? And so I think of humans as a result of evolution, as we do when we talk scientifically, right? And so because we are the result of the very long process of evolution, we are not really rational beings. So what we want to lead is the good life. And in a way, rationally, we can understand what the good life is. And if we were comparing notes between the Stoics and the Buddhists, we would see probably differences, but a lot of similarities in how to understand the good life. Consuming as much as possible, having as much sex as possible, eating as much marzipan chocolate, this is my favorite chocolate, as much as possible. This is not how these traditions understand the good life. So understanding the good life is not really the problem. The problem is that though we have rationality, we have also a lot of other stuff in our mind because we are the product of this long evolution. And so to understand that, I usually use Daniel Kahneman's distinction between system one and system two, or cognition one and cognition two. Cognition two is frontal cortex or whatever, whichever part of the brain you want to associate reason with, right? It's our rational ability to reason, to control ourselves through reason, and all these important things that we have as human beings. That system one, two, sorry, sits on top of a much more powerful system, which Kahneman called system one, which is the way in which we behave spontaneously all the time. Now, from a Buddhist perspective, what is particularly important is what Buddhists call Vedana, which you can translate as feelings and sensation. That is, all the time that we are awake or even dreaming, our brain constantly parses our experience in terms of good, bad, neutral. Good, bad, neutral. And it does that all the time. And so now this is not the problem. The problem is that we are conditioned to react stereotypically to this input, to this sensation, feelings, yes. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So when we feel good, we want more, 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 more. When we feel bad, we react with aversion. I don't like it. No, 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 right?
Yeah.
And it is these conditionings that for Buddhists are the central problem of human beings. And to deal with these conditionings, we can use system two. But the problem is that system two is not very powerful. It's very smart, but it's not very powerful. It's very slow. And so what we do when we do that, we engage in a kind of fight with a system which is actually much more powerful than system two. And so the strategy that I think is important for people to develop is the strategy of paying attention to the sensations that we are produced in us by when we encounter whatever experience we encounter. And this is what mindfulness is largely about, a way to pay attention in a non-reactive way to whatever sensation arises in our organism. And if we pay attention in this way, then we kind of weaken the power of system one and create a space for us to get better control of mind, or to move our mind in a more wholesome and productive way, rather than kind of follow the impulsions that comes from the sensation that arose in us, right?
Yep.
And so that's this skill which I think is important for the good lives, that I wanted to recommend to people as a way to enable us to deal with this level of experience, which in a way sets the scene for what happens at a more kind of cognitive level. Judgments are obviously important, but judgment comes after a lot of things already. First and foremost, this sensation, and then this kind of conditioned response that we have to our sensations. And that's why I think mindfulness would be really useful for people who want to cultivate their mind, right? Who think that happiness comes from cultivating one's mind, of controlling one's mind, as these traditions do. So this is what I think is important and interesting here to talk about.
Well, that's really interesting to me. It sounds a little bit to me like the Stoic theory of passions, and maybe I'll just rehearse that a little bit,
please.
and see if that's, if it seems to match up to you, right? So on the Stoic view that we find, and there's a great book on this by Margaret Graver, for anybody who wants to look at that. We're sort of impacted by the world in these ways that they call propatheia, or proto-passions is a way to do it. And that we're sort of, we respond to them as though they're good, bad, or not at all, right? Then what happens, that the mistake that most of us make is that we then bring a judgment to bear on that, oh, this really is bad, or oh, this really is good, and we assent to that, is this technical term. And then it kind of runs away on its own power, right? So, so we get impacted by, was the marzipan chocolate, for example.
Yes.
Oh, this is great.
My favorite example.
Yeah.
It's really a loaded example.
But what the Stoics do is they recommend that what we do is we change the judgments we bring to this interaction with the world. And the hope is that with enough training, I think, our reactions become more disciplined.
Yeah.
And so then we're no longer living lives run by these passions in this way, these pathe. Does that sound?
Well, like that's what I call the top-down strategy, right?
Right.
I think, so if we try to compare the different psychologies, which is what we're talking about here, I would insert one step between the sensations and the judgment, which is this kind of conditioned reaction of grasping or rejecting, right? And this is, from the Buddhist point of view, this is the key, this is the most damaging conditioning. Now, you're right. After this reaction, what comes in of this judgment, right, which kind of reinforce and we kind of spin out of control,
right,
but kind of rehearsing, rehashing, ruminating, and so on, right? But between this sensation and this judgment, I think there is this kind of strong attitude of either clinging to or rejecting. And so the problem with a top-down solution is that it's kind of have trouble defanging system one. So it's tried to reconceptualize. And so what I think would be helpful is to try to combine the two approaches, so as to develop mindfulness, which then kind of create, kind of disarm the system one, kind of neutralize, kind of lessen its impact, right? And then I think a kind of reconceptualization can be more effective. Because my problem is that and I'm sure I'm the only one, but is that when I try to use this judgment, which I do, like thinking that, you know, attachment is a bad thing and so on, that it really imprison us rather than bring us happiness, that I can think about that, okay, and yeah, for 10, 20 minutes, it's okay, then desire comes back, right?
Yep.
Because it's this powerful kind of slug mind, which is very kind of limited, very rigid, but very powerful, right? And so what I find helpful is to try to combine this kind of reconceptualization with mindfulness, because mindfulness allows me to neutralize, at least to a certain extent, the power of what I called system one, right? Which is these impulses.
Yeah, so when you were talking about system one and system two, something else came to my mind in terms of the Stoic approach, and this is from Epictetus specifically. There are two aspects of what Epictetus says to his students that I think, of course, he didn't know anything about neuroscience and system ones and system two, but it sounds like he had some kind of intuitive understanding of these differences that you're making between, you know, yes, I can rationally think about some stuff, but then the desire comes in and it overwhelms me. And the two components, the two aspects of Epictetus' teachings that I think are germane to this discussion are, one, when he says to his students, like, you know, whenever you have an impression, that is a first immediate judgment about things, what you need to do is to slow down. What you need to do is to say, hold on, impression, you're not necessarily what you claim to be, so let me think about it. That may be understood in modern terms as an attempt to slow down things so the system two can in fact kick in, so that you can say, hold on, I'm not going to react immediately to this thing, I need my time, I need to slow down. But of course this is not always possible. There are lots of situations where you do not have the luxury to step back and say, hey, let me think about this stuff. You had to act in the moment. And that is why I think Epictetus has his third discipline. He tries to train his students in three disciplines, the desire and aversion, which is reconceptualizing basically what is really good for you and what is not good for you, right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to what people normally think is good or not good for you. The second discipline is of action, which deals with how to interact with other people. But the third discipline is interesting to me in this context. It's often referred to as a discipline of ascent. And Epictetus tells us that the point of the discipline of ascent is to make those judgments that initially will take you time and initially will take you this, I need to have distance between the impression and my reaction, to make them automatic, to make it a snap thing. Because he says, a lot of the times we don't have the time or we're not conditioned to stop and think about it. We may be tired, we may be hungry, we may be, you know, almost, you know, falling asleep or something, and yet we still need to make judgments. And so if you work toward kind of automating essentially these judgments, then they will come to you without the need essentially to mm-hmm. engage what we call system two. So it sounds like he uses system two as a training, you know, as a break, as a, okay, you need to slow down, until you've actually done this so many times that the judgment becomes now, the right judgment becomes automatic. And it is in that context that he uses the word prosoche, that is often translated simply as attention. I mean, some modern Stoic authors do translate it as mindfulness, but in fact, the Greek word means attention. All that Epictetus is basically telling us is like, you need to pay attention to what you're doing. You need to either do it deliberately if you can, by slowing down, or because you have now trained yourself to the point where you can do it automatically, but you need to pay attention to what you're doing and why you're doing it.
Yeah, okay. I think what is important in, what is helpful in mindfulness is obviously the paying attention. I think that's very similar. And I think that's very important, because often that we get into bad attitudes because we are caught in our own mind and we're not paying attention to what's going on in our mind, right? So that's obviously very important. I think together with attention, what is very helpful is to learn how to disidentify from one's own mental state so as to lessen the power of the urges that we have to react with desire of aversion, right? And so I think that's what I think is interesting in the mindfulness practice, which is a practice of disidentifying yourself with your mental state so that you start to be able to sift through them more effortlessly. Obviously, developing the right habit is going to be very important, but I think equally important is this habit of looking into one's mind and learning to see what's happening without being carried away by what is happening, right? And that's where the art of is, right? Because it's not so easy, especially when you are in a situation which calls for your attention, right?
Yeah, that's right, that's correct. So before I ask you the next question, I'm gonna wanna remind the audience that this is the time for you guys to post questions. If you haven't so far, there's been a lot of action in the chat, but it's been mostly about audience talking to each other and posting a bunch of quotes and links. But if you want to ask a question to George, that this is the time to sort of start formulating one and put it in the chat, and Rob and I will pick something. But my next question to you, George, is based on an essay by Owen Flanagan that I read some time ago, because what is it, a year and a half or so ago, I put out, I co-edited a book on how to live the good life, which basically mm-hmm. explores different traditions, including Buddhism, and of course, Stoicism. And Owen wrote the chapter on Buddhism, and he wrote something that I thought was interesting, that, and I want to hear sort of your take on it. He said that he once had a, very early on when he was sort of starting getting interested in Buddhism, he had the opportunity to interview the Dalai Lama. And Owen was surprised to find that during that interview that Buddhists, pretty much like Stoics, at least, so that's, this is the idea, think that anger is a unhealthy emotion. And in fact, they think that it's a major problem that sort of needs to be taken care of. And Stoics are the only other tradition that I know of, the only tradition, at least in the West, that I know of, that explicitly says anger is just always a bad idea. The standard take in the West is the Aristotelian, which says a little bit of anger is okay, you can control it, etc. And to which Seneca famously, so Aristotle says anger is a weapon that you need to use, you know, learn how to use. And Seneca responds, well, that would be nice if it weren't for the fact that the weapon actually owns me and not the other way around.
That's a problem.
So I can't exactly just pick it up. So what's your take on that?
Yeah, that's exactly the problem, is that, anger is really dangerous, because when anger comes, it owns us, it controls us. And so now, it would be nice if we could use anger like a little bit, right? To react to something, to mark our disapprobation, to mobilize some energy to react to a situation. The problem is that anger controls us and leads us to very bad things such as hatred and so on. And so I think it's very important to be able to understand the destructive power of anger, and because it's a very powerful emotion, right? And so if we could use it a little bit and control it, that would not be a real problem. But Seneca is exactly right. If we get angry, that anger tends to control us because it is so powerful. It's another example of the system one we are talking about, right? Yeah. And so, that's the problem of anger. So I think Buddhists are pretty much in agreement with Stoics on understanding anger as a real danger for the the good life. And I think it's particularly important for people who are interested in politics, because I think politics foster a great deal of anger, and that is not a very healthy, a little bit of it is okay, but then we get into the same problem that it's hard to control, and then we get carried away to kind of hate other people and so on. Fighting against other people is one thing, hating other people is another thing. And so I think that one of the reasons I'm interested in Stoicism is that I think it's a good model for Western Buddhists, for Buddhist modernists like myself, because Buddhism, as it exists in Asia, is based on this tradition of renunciation, right? You become monk, nun, or you are a layperson who supports the monks and nuns, and so on. And most Western Buddhists and modern Buddhists, because people in Bangkok are not that different, most of the these kind of people, modern people, people who really want to participate in the modern world, find themselves kind of in between monks and traditional laity. They're not like monks and nuns who devote themselves full time to the practice, but they are not like lay people who just support monks and then give them alms and do some ritual. They want to meditate, they want to cultivate their mind, but because they are not monks and nuns, they are interested also in politics, and they should be, because given they are not monks and nuns, they are citizens of the country, and if they are lucky enough to have a democracy, they should participate in it. And I think that's why for Buddhists, the example of the Stoics is a good example of a tradition that cultivates wisdom within a context of engagement with the civic life. And that's, I think, very much what many Western Buddhists want to do. And in that perspective, I think that anger is a major problem, because political action leads so easily to anger and hatred. And I think if we want to cultivate the good life as a member of the city, we have to try to learn to control/cultivate our mind in a way that avoid us being consumed by anger when we deal with political situation, which, as we have seen, can be very difficult.
That's right. I mean,
and very troublesome.
You know, one of the things that strikes me as interesting is every single time that I put out on social media an article on Stoicism and anger, there's a lot of angry people who answer. They say, I have a right to be angry. I want to be angry. It's like, well, you certainly have the right. The question is, you know, is it doing you and the rest of society any good?
Yes.
Or is it doing more good than harm? You know, that's the question, not whether you have the right or not.
Yes, exactly.
Now, Rob, you have the next question, I think.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, some of the things that you've just been saying, and we've hinted at along, remind me of some ideas I've had. I've been reading your book, The Sound of Two Hands Clapping, which I'm enjoying. I haven't finished yet, but one of the things that jumps out at me, and I think this is because I've been thinking about it quite a bit, is this tension. It seems like a tension between what we might call something like the life of pure intellect and the life of practice, right? Mm-hmm. So how much thinking controls our developing and coming to understand and trying to live the good life, and how much are other practices are involved in the training and development of that. And I see what looks like a tension in your story in that book, and also, the Hellenistic philosophy is filled with this sort of tension, and also through the work of more recent scholars like Foucault and Hadot. Can you say something about that?
Yeah, I think it's a very deep tension in Buddhist tradition. You find this tension between learning, scholarship, intellectual life, which is very much value. But at the other side, there is the practice of meditation, which often takes a non-discursive aspect, because you need to develop attention, single-pointed attention, and all these important qualities. And so that tension exists in Buddhism, and it's an ongoing tension that inhabits all the Buddhist traditions, and that exists also between Buddhist traditions. So this is very much at the heart of Buddhist tradition, because Buddhist tradition has developed as a very rich intellectual culture, valuing the intellect and valuing learning and so on. At the same time, it is cultivating practice that requires, that are non-discursive, right? And so that's very much a tension throughout Buddhism. So you find in the Buddhist world, people like me who tend to be much more scholar and intellectual than meditator. And then you find other people who have tend to be much more bent on meditation. And that's a question of what are your predilections and your capacities, because not everybody is cut equally to do either. And then obviously you have exceptional people who manage to be both, but that's not easy. So I present myself essentially as a scholar who is interested in meditation. Other people are much more bent on meditation than myself. I think of myself as a Buddhist philosopher first and foremost. But obviously, meditation is something that is important as well. So when I begin my career as a Buddhist monk, I'm not a monk anymore, let's make clear that everybody understands. I first learned the language and the basis of Buddhism and so on. And then I was with a friend who was a French friend. And so we went to see the Dalai Lama. And we said, okay, we have learned the language, the basics, and so on. What do we do? And so he told us, yeah, there are two careers. You can become a scholar, and you will spend a lot of time learning that, but that's going to be worthwhile, and it's going to help your practice. Or you can try to be a meditator. It's harder, but obviously, it's if you succeed, and that's a big if, you can... you can really develop yourself more deeply than just learning the philosophy. And so this is the two paths, this is the tension, and some people are able to reconcile the two to a high degree. Some people struggle more, but this is what is involved in, this is the two aspects of Buddhism that are, I think, important to keep in mind. Because often in the West, Buddhism is identified as a kind of anti-intellectual culture, which when you go to see Buddhist traditions, particularly in the Tibetan, but also in the Theravada world and in Chinese Buddhism, certainly, you see a lot of learning, a lot of philosophizing, and so on. And so I think it's important to understand that there are these two aspects which are complementary. At the same time, they're in tension with each other. So it's a kind of dialectical relation, which everybody is struggling to us more or less.
Right. And it sounds like from your description that the sort of direction one takes on that path is kind of subjective, right? What is a person's talents and predilections?
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. Great. Thanks for that.
Guys, we only have a few minutes, and we have a good number of really good questions in the chat. So I'm going to try, you know, Rob and I will try to get at least two or three in. The first one that I want to ask you, George, is from Ying Nan, who writes from Taiwan. And she's asking a practical question that is, in terms of, you know, what are some of the practices or techniques that we can actually do for disidentification cultivation? She says, you know, it's meditations, reading, sports, solitude, fasting. What is it? What kind of practical things work?
The Buddhist way is to learn how to focus, right? And then from that focus is to learn how to open the spectrum of attention and learn how to observe things without identifying with that. And that's basically the training. For example, the most basic Buddhist meditation is on the breath, right? And this is, you start by focusing on the breath, maybe work with one point. And then when you have some degree of concentration of attention, then you can open the specter of your attention and start to notice, and then constantly cultivate this attention of constantly going back to your breath as a kind of anchor, so that you don't get carried away by your own thoughts, which unfortunately happen all too often. So I think that's the standard Buddhist way to try to disidentify from what we could call the passions, right? And that's the kind of practice that takes years to cultivate, right?
Great. Bob.
Yep. I'm going to ask this question from my friend Ranjini. And she asks, I think the Buddhist ideas of emptiness is helpful in dealing with craving and attachment. In our contemplations, we see that the objects of our desire are ultimately empty, so we don't solidify what we desire. And she finds the meditations on emptiness and the Heart Sutra very useful. And she wondered if you have thoughts or a response to that.
Yeah, this is a level of Buddhist practice that I have not talked about, because we cannot talk about everything. But yes, mindfulness is not the goal, right? It's a way to get what is really the central practice in Buddhist meditation, at least understood by later commentators as insight, right? What Theravada called vipassana, but every Buddhist tradition has its own practice of what they call insight. And insight from the Buddhist perspective is insight into the no-self, empty nature of the person. And so that's a kind of higher level of Buddhist practice. Mindfulness is a way to prepare oneself to understand this deeper aspect of the human person, right? And so, yes, once you get to that, that's obviously tremendously helpful to be able to disidentify with our conditionings, right? So that's the, in a way, central practice, is this practice of insight. And if you cultivate insight into the no-self impermanent nature of the person, then at some point you get to some profound experience which transform you in much deeper way. So this is a long way, right? But what I was trying to emphasize is a more kind of directly usable capacity, which is this capacity to be attentive without identifying with the content of our mind, as something which is much easier to cultivate. And if people do some kind of training in mindfulness meditation, this is what they will quickly learn how to do. Then you have to cultivate it on your own, and nobody says it's easy.
Great. Got a few more minutes. I'm going to pick yet another question from the audience. Georgina, she says she's a practicing Buddhist. She has been for over 20 years, and more recently she got into studying Stoicism. And she sees a lot of similarities, but there are also some differences. And so she wants to focus on one of what she perceives to be a difference. The place that she sees a difference is where Buddha has said, and she's paraphrasing, there are many times when you have to trust your inner self. and disagree basically with your rational self, even if I have said it. Now, the Stoics, on the other hand, tend to be very much into, you know, discarding or overriding your gut feelings or your intuitions and actually scrutinizing them as much as possible. So it's definitely a philosophy that is based on as much use of explicit reasoning mm-hmm. as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think that is a valid distinction? What's your thought about those that particular?
Well, thought? Obviously I don't, I think that formulation of trusting your true self is as un-Buddhist as you can make it to be in a tradition that cultivate no self, right? So no, I don't buy that. But it is true that I don't buy that formulation, but I think that formulation refers to a way of trusting your spontaneous reactions, right? And I think that's possible after a long development when you have really cultivated yourself, and then you can trust your instinctual reactions much more. So one of the great virtue that Buddhism recommends to cultivate is loving kindness and compassion, right? And so, yes, then when your meditation of loving kindness and compassion has developed, then you have spontaneous reactions that are informed by this development, right? So I think in this way, the person is quite right, that there is a way in which these wholesome habits become our second nature. And so yeah. we can trust them more and more, right?
Yeah. So in that sense, it's actually not that different from what I was saying earlier yeah. about Epictetus, that he says, yeah. you know, you need to be very aware of what you're doing, but the more you do it, the more it becomes second nature. And once you become second nature, then you can actually trust your immediate reactions, because now yeah. that you've been trained. Sometimes I come up, I present the analogy of, you know, somebody learning to drive a car. Initially, it's nerve-wracking because you have to pay conscious mm-hmm. attention to everything because you don't know what you're doing. But the more you actually do it, the more your brain sort of learns that some of these things yeah. become automated and you don't have to think about them.
Yeah, anymore. And the more your intuition become educated, right?
Which right, exactly.
I think this is a Greek ideal, which I think is also can be found as a Buddhist ideal, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yes, educating your intuitions is actually a very good way to put it. George, it's been an hour, so I think we're going to have to wrap it up.
Okay.
But thank you so much for joining
my
us.
My pleasure.
It was fun.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, thanks so much, and it was great to meet you, George.
Likewise, and I hope we can renew that at some point.
Excellent. Definitely, looking forward to it. So before we go, I just got a quick reminder that the next episode of Philosophy as a Way of Life will feature authors Megan Sullivan and Paul Blanco on their book, The Good Life Method, Reasoning Through the Big Questions of Happiness, Faith, and Meaning. For that one, you can join us on Thursday, March 3rd at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And to do so, you need to go on meetup.com to register. Look up the New York Agora. In the meantime, you can listen to past episodes of Philosophy as a Way of Life, including the one that we're just about to wrap up, by going to anchor.fm/philosophy as a way of life. We'll see you soon. Stay safe.